In other words, if you look at the two texts, you have a feeling that even though the Joseph story is a story, is not theory or philosophy, what the Joseph story tells you is people like Joseph or Oedipus are scapegoated. Not one time, not twice, not three times, four times, all the time. They are always expelled. And it's a lie. And the proof that this scapegoating is really the subject of the Joseph story, which it is not in the case of the Oedipus myth. When I say to my fellow scholars, the Oedipus myth is a scapegoat story, they say, show me the scapegoat. But I say, when there is a real scapegoat, it doesn't show. Everybody believes he's guilty. You see what I mean? If the text tells you the scapegoat is a scapegoat, the text is not built on scapegoating. The text is a denunciation of scapegoating, which is what the Joseph story is. There you see the scapegoat. In the Oedipus myth, you don't see it because it's really a scapegoat text generated by scapegoating and which remains generated by scapegoating like all archaic religion. And the proof of what I say is the last episode of the Joseph story. Because in the last episode of the Joseph story, Joseph is sitting on that huge pile of grain, you know, in a world which is entirely destroyed by starvation. And all his brothers are with the father in Palestine, and they say, oh, you know, in Egypt, they say they have a guy who will give you grain because they have some and so forth. So they all go to Egypt. But they don't take their last born, Benjamin, who is the only real brother of Joseph, because the father, Jacob, had two wives. And his favorite wife was only the mother of Joseph and Benjamin. So since the disappearance of Joseph, Benjamin is the favorite of Jacob. So the 11 brothers leave, and they leave Benjamin with Jacob, you know, because traveling was dangerous in those days. And they are nice enough to their father, they don't want anything to happen to Benjamin. And they get to Joseph, you know, with the prime minister of Egypt. And they don't recognize him because he's so well-dressed, so they are terrified, really. And Joseph recognizes them, of course, and he gives them grain. And he says, but don't you have another brother? Or maybe two? So they said, well, we had two, but they don't want to talk too much about that. And they say, yes, we have another one, Benjamin, you know, the youngest born, and we didn't take him along because our father is very old. And if Benjamin died, if we die, well, too bad. But if Benjamin died, you know, he would die too. So Joseph says, if you're hungry again, and if you come back, be sure to bring Benjamin with you. Or this second time you won't get anything. So they go back, you know, they tell the story to their father, and they eat all the grain and so forth, and after that they are hungry. And they try, you know, not to go back, but finally they are so hungry that they go back. And Jacob himself tells them, bring Benjamin with you. It's better to, you know, to die a violent death than to die this slow death of starvation. You go back to Joseph. So they go back to the Joseph with Benjamin, you know. And Joseph recognizes them again. He recognizes them again and gives them grain. Then he has them all arrested at the border and searched. And he himself has directed his servants to place his precious cup into the bag of Benjamin. And he complains loudly that it's been stolen, and probably by all these brothers. That's why he has them searched. And when they find the object in the bag of Benjamin, he says, I keep him, and you can all go. You're free. He's testing them. He wants to see if they are going to do again to Benjamin, in circumstances a little bit similar, what they did to him, Joseph. You see? And what happens then? 10 of the brothers are ready to go. But the 11th, Judah, who according to the story is the ancestor of Jesus, Judah says, no, I cannot stand this, you know, because my father, take me instead of him. I prefer to be the scapegoat, you know. So Joseph is very touched by that, and he acknowledges all his brothers. It's enough for him that one would not repeat the scapegoat process for him to forgive all of them, you know. So it's a very beautiful story. And it's an anti-scapegoat story, obviously. And what is proved is that even though men are very bad, sometimes there is one out of 12 or out of 100 who is less bad, who is ready to do something, you know. Now, traditionally, the Christians have seen this as a prophecy of Christ. All the scholars find this enormously funny. You see what I mean? How could it be? Absolutely no connection, and so forth. But the connection is obvious. The connection is obvious because Jesus dies a scapegoat death in order to do away with all scapegoat death, in order to reveal scapegoat death. Therefore, he's doing exactly the same thing as Judah. He's preferring to die instead of the scapegoat. So, of course, if you interpret prophecy in a very naive way like the Middle Ages did, it is true that it is not a specific allusion to a certain individual in a certain text in the future and so forth, but it's the same situation. And Judah behaves like Christ in the Gospels, in the sense that he's ready to be the scapegoat in order to do away with scapegoating, which I think is the real meaning of the act of Jesus. You say, why should it? Well, why should it do anything? Because the death of Jesus is written in the Gospels not as the Oedipus myth, but as the story of the Lamb of God. In other words, as the story that tells you the truth of scapegoating instead of telling you the lie, brings it out in the open, which is what people don't see. If a text brings out the scapegoat in the open, and certainly it's out in the open, they all hated me without a cause. In the Gospel, you no longer have a scapegoat story. You have the revelation of how the scapegoating works, which is the reason why we are so concerned with it in our world. But the Oedipus myth will never teach you that, because only the Gospels reveals to you that behind the Oedipus myth, there is the same process as in the Joseph story, but a process which is hidden because it works. And therefore it creates the text. It generates a text in which the culprit has really, really, between quotation marks, killed his father and so forth. In order to interpret the myth, you must break it apart, not respect its themes, and say it's exactly the same thing as witch hunting in the Middle Ages, a myth. When we see the trial of a witch in the 15th century, she's accused of that sort of thing. And everybody agrees. Sometimes she agrees too. And the judges too. But we say, no, no. It cannot be true. Because this type of accusation, parricide and incest that caused the plague, we don't believe in that. Well, we still believe in it. We believe in it as far as the Oedipus myth is concerned. Because we haven't learned to see that the Gospels should teach us to treat mythology as if it were a witch hunt document, a witch hunt slander. We don't see the witch hunt slander in all mythology, but we are seeing it in our own history since we don't read witch trials. You see what I mean? So what I would like to do, what I think I'm trying to do, is to bring the process of Christian revelation one step further by showing that what we do on witch hunting in the Middle Ages, you know, scapegoating of the Jews here and everybody, someone else there. We should realize that myths are documents of scapegoating, which have been treated as sacred things, and therefore we do not realize that they are what they are. And therefore, in that way, that the Gospels are a unique document, because they bring about that undoing of a fundamental cultural lie, which is present in all these myths, in all archaic religion, and which is always there as long as you don't denounce it. Which is there, therefore, in my view, behind philosophies, you know, and all type of thinking which does not question the basis of social thinking and of the unity of the community. Therefore, I think that many of the problems we are going through, you know, and the perpetual revolution that the Western world is connected to the work of revelation in our world. The presence of the work of revelation in our world has but is no longer a question of faith. It works its way in the questioning of these things, even if we pay no attention to the gospel. The poison has been introduced in our system and is slowly disintegrating the satanic system of human culture. I speak a little too dramatically here because there are extenuating circumstances. But nevertheless, you see what I mean? You see how, I need questions here again. You see how I'm getting to trying to show that Christian revelation has something to do deeply with what is happening in our world, which seems to us, and in many ways, is something bad, something difficult to experience, something painful, which is our cultural instability, our problems, you see what I mean, with cultural instability. And there is much misuse of the Christian revelation in our world, precisely because it works its way through us very often in non-Christian way. Nevertheless, I think our cultural problematic and the problems of our world and the way we conceive human relations and the changes in its conceptions are all entirely dominated by the slow working through of this revelation of victimage, scapegoating of its role in human culture. Okay, yeah. Questions. The other day at Stanford, we were talking about a text in Corinthians 1. First Corinthians chapter 2. You know, which is a very strange statement of Paul, which is, if the powers of this world had known, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. Now, what are the powers of this world? The powers, principalities, and so forth are defined in the Acts in a very strange way. They are defined as being united against Jesus, being all participants in his passion. This is not a historical statement, in my view. It is true that the powers which were present in Palestine, the Roman power, the Jewish religious authorities, gang up against Jesus. And Luke, for good measure, adds Herod because he's a power. I think it's a more general statement. It's a definition of the powers. The definitions of the definition of the power is those who gang up against Jesus. See, it's mad. No. It means that they are defined by the type of murder that I told you is like the passion. That they are defined by this collective murder. It's another definition of culture. The powers of this world is a very strange notion because it's partly very concrete, you know, it's a worldly affairs, and there is something spiritual. When the Gospels say celestial powers, it means exactly the same thing as the powers of this world. They have a transcendence of their own. It's not the real one. It's a scapegoat transcendence. It's a transcendence of Satan, I have to say. That doesn't mean they're all bad, because they're only a way to keep order before Christ. But they are defiant. So the powers of this world have crucified the Lord of glory, because it's their business. That's the way they regenerate themselves. That's the way they are born. That's the way they exist. And it's still true today. So why, if they had known, they would not have crucified the world? What they did not realize is that by crucifying the Lord of glory, their secret, the idea of a secret of Satan, you know, sounds magical, but it's not. It means that the scapegoat business, which is the union of the community against the victim, which is revealed in the gospel, is what dissolves the power once people realize this unity is not based on solid judgment, you know, conviction, but on mimetic influencing, on a crowd effect, a mob effect. You see what I mean? Therefore, if the powers of this world had known, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory, because by crucifying him, they exposed their main trick, the trick of Satan. That's why the powers today have been even trickier than before. But it's a very delicate affair. Now the powers of this world are always for victims. They are defenders of victims. They are the greater defenders. You see what I mean? Or they try to be. And they make a big mess out of our world. But nevertheless, they cannot fool us. They can fool us less and less. And they were fooled. The idea, you see, there is the idea in the early church that they are fooled by the passion, which has never been explained, and which I think can be explained in the way I told you.
Okay, shall we take about a 10-minute break and come back for questions?